You're listening to Discovering Multifamily, where we discuss all educational topics in commercial real estate with an emphasis on multifamily apartment investing via syndication. And now, your hosts, former NFL fullback Brian Leonard and Anthony Scandariato.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Discovering Multifamily podcast. I'm your host, Anthony Scandariato with Red Knight Properties. And today we have a special guest with us, Nathan Trujillo. And he's the Senior Director of Sales and Marketing at Lima One Capital, which is a private lender that assists real estate investors in financing solutions for mostly the multifamily, but he does single family fix and flips, obviously in the multifamily, the rental properties, portfolios, construction. They really specialize in the value add apartment buildings, which is what my company Red Knight focuses on as well. So we're here today to kind of talk about what's the state of the market. We're recording this in early November of 2020, and obviously we know a lot has changed in a bad way, and then now it's coming back in a good way. So we definitely want to hear Nathan's perspective on what's been going on and what we can expect to see for 2021 in the debt world as it relates to bridge and multifamily. So Nathan, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Anthony. Really excited about it.
Awesome. So what's going on? What's going on in this crazy world right now?
Man, a lot of craziness. That's what's going on. I know, COVID hit and everybody talked about the uncertainties. And although there's been a lot of clarity in a number of regards, there's still a lot of uncertainties that's affecting the debt space. So in a number of regards in debt, things have come back to where they are. At least a lot of people are back online. But I don't think on all sides, even the lending side, as well as the operator side, it's recovered to the place that we want it to be. There's still a lot of conservativeness going on, and we can certainly dive into that, especially related to bridge. But with all that unknown going on out there, it's tough to sort of expect lending to be back to where it was. So we're all in this new world, working to do new business as best we can. It's tough sledding out there. It really is tough. You know that for a fact when, unfortunately, a lot of the mainstay names, especially in the bridge space, they're just not even lending still. Some of the big trees or medium-sized trees have fallen down and not getting back up. So there's some big voids in a number of places in the financing space. You see some private lenders like us, as well as local banks, your regional banks, picking up a lot of market share. To where a lot of the sort of CMBS or CLO sort of type lenders are starting to get the traction back, but again, just not quite there.
Right. So you mentioned shops have kind of shut down. What do they mean? They closed or have they just stopped lending? Like, what do you mean by that?
So as of recent, a couple of middle market bridge lenders, I won't state their names, but mainly backed by different publicly traded mortgage REITs, have announced that they're just going to asset manage. And usually reading in between the lines, it's because of performance loans and certainly properties there within. So it's, for the most part, most people are back with a new products, new programs, restricted at that. But a couple of them, as of recently, have announced that they're not coming back in the near future and they're just focusing on asset management.
Okay, so what do you mean by restrictions? Some of the bridge that I've worked with bridge lenders and they stopped lending, now they're back lending, but it doesn't mean that it's the same as before. So what exactly has changed?
Yeah, so great question and a lot of ways to go with that. But just to, from a structural product standpoint, the first that everybody knows is proceeds and leverage, right? So certainly restricted. In number of realms of the bridge space, you could get somewhere with an 80% loan to cost before for your home run deals and 75% for ones that might be a little bit tougher. Essentially, from a leverage perspective, we've dropped down about 5% to each of those buckets. So the down the middle bridge deals are going to be 75% loan to cost in most places, not all, but most. And then with a little bit of hair or some, questioning to market, sponsor, business strategy, the 70% realm. So we've seen that there. As far as LTVs, you're seeing about the same. 5% hit and reduction, just not as aggressive. For the most part, underwriting is really just, you know, adjusting to the downside risk. So outside of that, there are some restrictions on how heavy a CapEx plays there can be, which to me is always just a little bit interesting, because what you don't want to do is handcuff a good operator on their budget, that's for sure. But, you know, some certainly restrictions in how much CapEx you can finance. The other big one that also ties into requiring more equity and liquidity are reserves. So a lot of lenders are requiring you to prepay your interest. Some of them will allow you to utilize that interest. Some of them will just take interest reserves and will reimburse it back through performance or getting it to certain debt yields or debt service coverage ratios. So that certainly is a big risk there. And then the last one that we all know is the window rates. Rates have gone up in a lot of bridge spaces, especially early on after, you know, post-COVID, they've settled back down. I mean, on the agency side, some phenomenal rates. And if you look at HUD, I mean, they're almost handing away the money. On the bridge stuff, you can still on middle market get in the mid to high fours, low fives. On the smaller balance, it's usually in the 7% to 9% range. So a little bit higher in regards to cost of capital, even lower proceeds when you add in the reserves. And then the overall underwrite, which I could certainly get into in more detail, is just being handled differently. I mean, you as an operator, Anthony, I'm sure you're handling your underwrites differently, so you can expect some of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, everybody's sort of protecting against the down and want to make sure they're not getting ahead of their skis.
Definitely. So can you talk a little bit more about – so I'm actually surprised with the rates that you threw out there, because I thought they would be higher on both the small balance and above that. So can you talk about the transitioning period? So for the audience who's out there that our operators might be considering using a bridge for maybe a light to medium value add multifamily deal, what's the advantage of using a bridge as opposed to just going agency, Fannie sure. Freddie debt, which you mentioned right away? Why would someone do that? I mean, I know the answer. I just want to.
Yeah, no, awesome question. And what I will delineate now is, pre-COVID, you said light, medium, and heavy, repositions of the like. It was very viable to find financing on all those realms. Right now, the heavy repositions are really tough. So I want to just specify that. But why would you go bridge versus permanent debt? Usually a number of reasons. We're seeing a lot of agency fallout. So, agency loans are taking time and too much time where sellers are getting too antsy. And so somebody will come mid-process to a bridge lender like us to be able to execute with speed. So that would certainly be one option. The more strategic options are really going to be a couple of things. So first would be leverage. Most of the time, you're going to get higher attachment points, higher proceeds, higher leverage from a bridge lender, mainly because you're going in there to bridge the gap from A to B. Usually, B is a better place than A. So therefore, a bridge lender is going to be able to step out a little bit, give higher proceeds and leverage because of that value creation. Now, how we all underwrite value creation is a little bit different, and we can, again, get into that. But proceeds is usually one of the first reasons why somebody strategically goes to bridge. Another main one is certainly the restrictions or penalties for prepay. So whether that's defeasance or just straight prepayment penalties, most bridge lenders don't necessarily have that. If they do, it's very much nominal compared to agency. But what a lot of people don't realize, I know you do, Anthony, but a lot of operators don't realize how severe the penalties are if you're looking to exit an agency deal within the first 2 to 4, 2 to 5 years, depending on what the terms are. It's game changing. You get a lot of people that say you have to pay how much. So strategically, if you think you know the business plan or you think that there might be an exit in the 2 or 3 year mark, going a bridge route, a 2 year with a 1 year extension bridge route or a 3 year bridge route is going to allow you to have those options. The proceeds and the avoidance of prepay and defeasance are predominantly the biggest reasons why that most people are going bridge versus perm. Did I hit on the main buckets that you were, that you know?
Yes, exactly. So can you talk about some of the programs with the agencies? I know some of them are rolling out some pretty flexible prepays now, some of them just to be competitive with the bridge space. Can you mentioned, you know, I've done bridge deals before where there's no exit on the back end, but maybe there's a point and a half going in. Can you kind of talk about, you know, another reason why you may not get agency financing, especially if you're somewhat of a newer sponsor, you've never done business with the agencies before? Is that another reason why they may come to use Bridge?
That's a great point. So a lot of people, when they're building up their multi-portfolio, there are some requirements on the agency side that they might not be able to meet, as well as they're, for the most part, going to be a lot more stringent in verifying experience and previous proof of execution. And when you don't have that experience, then the requirements to qualify for agency loans are typically amplified, many times even doubled. So like, for example, a net worth requirement is usually going to be a 1-to-1 ratio. Your net worth has to equate to the agency loan amount. And then many times, if there's not that experience, then you have to show double in net worth what the agency loan amount is going to be. So similar restrictions to that and qualifications at that will be restrictive. And then Bridge as a whole, I mean, you know, look, you're paying a little bit in regards to the interest rate, many times the fee specifically as well, to go the Bridge route, but you're paying for it for a reason. So certainly the hurdles that you have to go through and the qualifications to have to get a Bridge loan typically it's a lower bar than when you have to go agency, as well as loan amount minimum. So, you know, if you're starting out and you don't have that experience and track record, and you have a loan or a loan request that's close to $1 million or sub $1 million, agency really isn't going to be able to facilitate that. You have to go for exceptions on the small balance side agency if it's under $1 million, and at that, it can be hard to get at times. So as you're growing your portfolio from a qualification standpoint, and then just sort of the common product that's needed, the Bridge route tends to be, you know, most feasible and easiest to execute on.
Great. And you mentioned, Nathan, timing. So you mentioned the agencies are very bogged down, especially right now, and sellers are anxious, especially just right now, to try to close by the end of the year. With the agency lender, probably pretty challenging. So how long does a Bridge loan take? Like, if I went to give you a Bridge loan, how long does that take versus the agency?
Yeah, great question. So your agency, if you're trying to close quicker than 60 days on the agency side, you're probably pushing your luck. Certainly people that are out there that frequently are acquiring via agency loans and are known sponsors and very experienced, there's many exceptions to the rule, but you know, you're only adding stress to your plate if you're looking to target closing in less than 60 days. On the Bridge side, something went completely wrong, at least in our world, if you got close to the 60 days. Right now, where the whole industry slowed down, I mean, you think about inspections and appraisals and getting access to units and the amount of notice you have to give. So, you know, the shortest before we used to quote about 3 weeks. Now it's probably about 4 to 6 weeks is the standard turn time. So still not ideal where we want to be. But there's a lot higher assurance to meeting that, you know, 30 days to 45 day time frame, even than a 60 day agency time frame. I think the one thing, when I go back to answer what your previous question about why Bridge versus agency, it's also the amount of scrutiny that's placed upon the asset, certainly on the sponsor, but especially nowadays, the asset on the agency side, it can be tough. And so everything's got to be up to the minute financials, rent rolls, they're scoured through, little bits of changes need a lot of reasoning. And then especially as you see common threads and trends of concessions nowadays to fill up occupancy, to sell it at the right price, you're getting knocked down throughout the underwriting process. So there's a lot more scrutiny on the asset level in agency that also – I bring that back up is because that elongates the process, right? So with Bridge, it's certainly more simplified, but 30 days is our main focus. You know, if things go a little bit longer for outside of control reasons, environmental reports or appraisal reports being slower, then it usually is the 45 day end of the spectrum on the Bridge side. That's in the world that we live in, which is more smaller balance.
Got it. And you talked about scrutiny from the asset level and that. Can you talk a little bit about the appraisal process? So the appraisal process from a bridge to regular bank or agency is a lot different than bridge. You look at two different values. Can you kind of explain how you guys look at that?
Yeah, great. Yeah, great. Great point and thing to bring up here. So as far as the, you know, how the appraisals physically are done, it's very similar, you know, as far as inspections. I will say on the bridge side, there's going to be more leniency for accessibility to units than there is on the agency side. And so that's where the third party appraisal reports might take longer than on the bridge side. But I know what you're looking at is on the bridge side, we're looking at really two values, and you could potentially stretch it to three, depending on how specific a bridge lender wants to get. So there's always your as-is and in-place value. You know, what's the property worth today? Certainly those appraisals can be tough when the property is not performing at all. But why that's looked at is that we in the bridge space want to be cognizant of how much we're lending and is deployed today versus the as-is value. So one thing just to keep in mind in that regards is that on a bridge loan, if you're financing CapEx of call it $250,000 and your loan amount is $1.25 million, we're looking at an attachment point typically of about $1 million on that asset because we're netting out the CapEx, which is going to be future investments, you know, in capital improvements, right? So, you know, we keep that in mind. So the loan amount to the as-is value is very important. And then the second half is, you're either looking at an as complete value, which is essentially the value of the property once any proposed renovations are complete, and even furthermore, an as stabilized value. The differentiation is as completes once you've, you know, done the construction aspect of it and not leased up, and then as stabilized is as it's further leased up. So for the most part, you're always looking at the best picture, which is as stabilized value. But it is important, even from a sponsor perspective, to know that there is still additional value creation needed after you've done the heavy lifting of the construction and you still need to do the lease-up play. Nowadays, with you know the trends that we're seeing, that lease-up can be a little bit less predictable than you know than we previously anticipated. So those are the two values, as is, and sort of the future value, which is predominantly as stabilized.
Got it. Can you talk a little bit about your – you mentioned what's the difference between, just for our listeners, loan to cost and loan to value? And just a follow-up question on that is, you mentioned the example $250,000. How do you guys, and we talked about this a little bit before the show, you know, typically when you use a bridge lender, you have to request disbursements of your construction budget. So how do you, just want to talk about that process from your perspective, because that's another reason why at least in the industry, not just myself, but some other operators, they don't like doing bridge because they don't want to deal with the draw requests. So can you talk a little bit about those two things?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are variations of bridge products that either, I mean, there's really two categories, I'll call it, which is, you know, a loan without any CapEx, without any construction and money's held back that can be recouped through draws, or ones that have it. So to go to the first part of the question, which was loan to cost versus loan to value, essentially you're taking your loan amount, loan to cost, taking your loan amount into the total cost of the project. At its most simplistic level, that's typically your purchase price plus your CapEx budget. In some loan amount calculations, they'll add in some of the other hard transaction costs, you know, lender fees, title fees, sometimes either sponsor fees. But for now, in the world we're in, it's for the most part purchase plus CapEx. And then loan to value is what your loan is to the current value of the property. Or you can look at on the single family call side, we call it loan to ARV, after repair value. What's your loan amount going to be after you complete your business plan, you've created value, and the property's worth more? So hopefully that differentiates the loan to cost and the loan to value. Yep. So in bridge loans, which is very common to finance CapEx, what lenders are looking for most of the time is for you to put together a budget that encumbers all the capital improvements, all the renovations you want to do in the property. Most underwriters do want to see, you know, that budget be aligned with what the actual expenses are going to be, meaning Certainly they don't want it to be more, because then there's takeout risk because your loan amount's higher after they funded all the CapEx budget. And for the most part, they don't want it to be much less, because then, again, it will handcuff investors, not allow them to have enough capital to, you know, to finish the project. They either have to bring in, you know, additional equity and invest it, or go raise it, which is not an ideal situation. As far as the draw process is concerned, there's a lot of different parts of the process, right? So whether it's soft costs or hard costs, they can be looked at differently. But the easiest one is to talk about hard costs. So if you are budgeting, again, back to my example of $250,000, and you're doing, you know, 20 units at $10,000, and you're doing $50,000 to fix up common areas, lenders is going to look for the most part at the actual work completed tied into your original scope of work. So therefore, if it was 20 units that were renovated at $10,000 a door, once you fully renovate a unit, you will get the full $10,000. Most lenders, unfortunately, which we briefly talked about, if you made deposits for your contractors or if you had materials on site, they won't give you that formal credit and reimbursement of it until it's actually, you know, installed or completed work. There certainly are variances in that. And especially when the budgets are larger, then you can allow for more of the soft costs to be funded up front, because there's a little bit more cushioning. But especially in this new world that we're in, unfortunately, lenders do want to see that work done. So, I mean, I've seen draw requests pushed back because cabinets were sitting there in a unit in boxes, and it was said, well, it's not completed work. Well, it's about to be. You see this material here. There's true value to it. And lenders do want to see the sponsor, you know, executing the business plan and have it tied to the asset, which creates value.
That makes sense. And can, what if your scope of work changes from your initial capital improvement budget? How do you go about requesting, if that is a situation? How do you go about requesting those changes, and who needs approval, and how does that work?
Awesome question, because it's a slippery slope. It's a tough one, right? Because at the end of the day, what you got to remember is, although some people call the Lima One and our peers hard money, all lenders want the deal to be successful, right? We also, with bridge deals, especially when there's CapEx, we understand things don't always go to plan, right? So we know that there's some variance. Typically, what I encourage up front is that you build in contingency funds. So if somebody had a $250,000 budget, they got a couple bids, or that's what they penciled it out to be, you know, you could recommend 5 to 10+% in contingency. So 10% contingency on 250 would be another 25 grand. That contingency money is not specified to be done to a specific unit or specific common areas. It is for the inevitable unforeseen. So that's one way to help prevent upfront, is to build contingency funds into your CapEx budget. But that doesn't always happen when you're swinging hammers, knocking down walls, and renovating units. So what you have to understand about change orders, change requests, or cost overruns when it comes to having a CapEx budget is that without modifying the loan documents and redoing the loan, almost refinancing it, lenders and borrowers have to keep the budget the same. So in my 250 example, if you all of a sudden open up walls and realize there's a major plumbing issue or electrical issue, the lender still can only work with 250,000. So depending on your lender, it will happen in a number of ways. My biggest piece of encouragement and advice is make sure you communicate as quickly and as early as possible. Lay out as much that you know about the issue and the resolution for it. Sort of common sense, but it is really important to keep communication up, because that perception on the lender side is not as good when it's all coming about after the fact and said, hey, I really need this 100 grand because we ran into this. Put it out once you identify it. That will go a long way. And then assuming that the lender is able to work with you, which again, they all want your deal to be successful, they may prorate down some of the other budgeted items to allow for room on the new item. Or the unfortunate circumstance is the lender will say, nope, you know, this, we know now, thank you. We know there's another 50 grand of work. You have to pay for that before we release any other monies. it's not the ideal answer, but that's the reality of some situations. So it's an unpleasant experience. I haven't personally experienced that being on the lender side, but you hear about it a lot of times and people come to us for refinances in those scenarios. But that's where it puts a lot of the emphasis up front and doing your proper due diligence, walk the property with a couple different contractors and tradesmen, which is hard to do with the timeframes that we're all trying to close in. But it certainly pays off. So again, budgets can be adjusted. The rest of the budget can be prorated down to open up space to allow for the unforeseen cost overruns. Some lenders will make you just pay it out in equity up front. But for the most part, again, lenders will work with you in just a variation of ways.
Got it. And that's actually an example. What if you were very under budget? Let's say you took out that $250,000 and then you only spent $100,000 and you got $150,000 and you want to take out the loan and whatnot. How do you, you don't necessarily, and I'm sure from a lender's perspective, have to use the money, right? But if you find an opportunity, let's say, and this actually is an example of what we had, we actually had some room in our budget with the bridge loan, and we found an opportunity to build more apartments. So what's your suggestion when you're under budget when reapproaching the lender? Because typically you need to provide a construction budget, right? And then if you need to adjust things, then you speak to the lender. So what's your advice in that situation?
Yeah. So there's a couple of different ways that I would look at this. If you're truly under budget, depending on how your loan was situated, if you're not paying interest on drawn funds, or if you are paying interest on undrawn funds, then obviously you really want to push really hard to make sure that you can get access to that capital to set aside for you to improve a property, because you're paying interest on it. In many scenarios, though, and as is the case with Lima One, when you're not paying interest on undrawn funds, then it's not as much pressure, but you still have that money set aside for it. So what you really want to do is show, in the scenario where you're pitching the lender, let's call it, for those additional funds, you got to put yourself in the lender's shoes. So what does a lender want? They want more security. And how can you deliver that is by showing proof that you are increasing the value of the property. In your scenario, creating additional units, which will drive additional income, which will then increase the value of the property, should be a no-brainer, in my opinion. But where it becomes difficult is when you're not really spending that money on something that's going to create value. Certainly, if you're taking care of deferred maintenance type stuff, that makes a lot more sense because it can affect the marketability of the property. But if it's just sort of it would be really cool if we put this up, like really cool signage, it might not be as well received. That's some of my feedback on it. I will say though, you got to understand, it's a good question to ask your lenders up front. How do they handle draws? Some lenders will want receipts and proof of invoices that you paid. Others will just follow your scope of work. So, what I always encourage is that if you add a little bit of padding to your CapEx budgets and a lender isn't looking for receipts, a lot of them are not because they're not set up to do that. They don't have construction management in-house. You can actually get sort of funded a little bit throughout the way. And then whether you're putting that money to the side or using it to do additional items on the property that you didn't originally put in your scope of work is one thing that I always recommend when a lender is funding off of completed work based on the original budget that's allotted.
Excellent. Great. Well, I think we've talked about a lot. Hopefully we got a crash course with bridge loan financing for multifamily. Nathan, how could people find you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can reach me directly always at ntrunfio@lima1.com. That's N-T-R-U, N as in Nancy, F as in Frank, I-O. Find me anywhere on social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Nathan Trunfio. And make sure you check out lima1.com. We really take a lot of pride in filling the void in small balance bridge loans for investors of all shapes and sizes.
Excellent. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'll have a link to Nathan's profile in the comment section on iTunes and in our social media. So feel free to reach out to him. And hopefully we'll see you again soon, Nathan.
You know you will. Thanks, Anthony.
All right. Thank you.